This is the Taylor Report. We're lucky to have Zafar Bengash with us. How are you, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. I'm fine, thank you.
There's so many things we need to ask you about, Zafar. I want to ask you, Pakistan is not in the forefront of our news, except in terms of the flooding and disaster. That story has been talked about. But the last time we spoke with you, what was the story was, and I assume remains, a dispute between the population as a whole and those who are currently in power, who through manipulation took power away from the Prime Minister Khan. I want to link this to discussion of what's going on in the Islamic Republic. I didn't recall anyone in Canada saying they were, let's all go out and take a stand on the side of those who are demonstrating against those who seized power in Pakistan. But today, all of our political leaders say, oh, we are with the people of Iran to remove the government of Iran. They never said that about Pakistan.
Exactly. Basically, as you said, the government, an elected government in Pakistan, was removed through a conspiracy, and that government was led by Imran Khan. He actually performed better than what many people had expected him to do, because he had inherited a terrible situation, an economic situation that was really bad. But he and his team managed to stabilize the economy, and they were on their way to establishing a kind of system whereby the country would become somewhat immune to foreign interference and foreign manipulation. And that was the reason why he was removed, because regrettably, in Pakistan, we have a very powerful military that basically decides who is supposed to rule and who is not supposed to rule. That is totally unconstitutional. The military has no constitutional authority to decide that. But the tragedy is that it is a powerful institution, and it is able to manipulate politicians, these other politicians who are basically corrupt. They are thieves. They are murderers. There are actual murder cases against these politicians that have been put in power. If the law were to take its own course, and regrettably, again, the courts basically receive directions from the military as to what kind of verdicts they should deliver. If the law were to take its course, 60% of the members of the current cabinet in Pakistan that has been installed, they would be in prison. So you see the situation. And at the same time, a really remarkable phenomenon has occurred in Pakistan's political history, that when Imran Khan was removed from power, literally millions of people came out into the streets, millions, all over the country. Now, the people are so upset by what the military has done by bringing these corrupt politicians, incidentally, at the behest of the United States. Or let me say that the United States wanted to get rid of Imran Khan because he refused to surrender to the Americans. He said, we want to be friends with the Americans, but we don't want to be America's slaves. Mm-hmm. And that's the sentiment that echoes throughout Pakistan. So just to give you an example, if Imran Khan's party issues a call that today, and they say that we are going to have a rally tomorrow, and usually these rallies are held at night because during the day it's so hot that it's very, very difficult for people to come out into the streets or into these huge arenas or grounds, etc. So they hold the rallies at night, and of course they light up the place. Every city throughout Pakistan, millions of people come out, and they say that this regime that has been imposed upon us, we reject it. We want fresh elections, free and fair elections, and let the people decide. But regrettably, the military gets in the way. and they are not allowing elections to take place. And in the meantime, of course, Pakistan's economy is going down the drain. Now, you drew a very interesting parallel with what is happening in the Islamic Republic of Iran, whereby all the Western regimes are clamoring, we are with the people of Iran. For what? An allegation has been made that a young woman, 22-year-old woman, died in police custody. Let me give you the sequence of events. Number one, she was arrested on September the 13th and taken to a police station, what they refer to in the media as morality police. Incidentally, women in Iran, that are arrested are dealt with by women police officers, not by male police officers. And the CCTV footage that has been released clearly shows that there was no physical contact between this girl, this 22-year-old girl, Mahsa Amini, and the police. There was, in fact, verbal exchange. This is clearly shown. And then the police ladies move away, and this young girl, Mahsa Amini, moves towards a row of chairs where other women are also sitting, and she's, of course, you know, coming from the back. She grabs a chair, and at that time, she collapses. This is shown on CCTV footage. And then she is taken to hospital, where she dies 3 days later. What had happened, this is what the hospital sources have said, that she, at that time, she had a heart attack because she had certain medical conditions prior. She had had a brain surgery a few years ago, and it was in hospital that she died. And they have sort of blown up into this, that the police killed her. Just to sort of give you an idea, the Iranian president, who happened to be right at that time when this girl died in hospital, he was in Samarkand for the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. When he heard of this, he did two things. He immediately issued a statement. He said, we regret this incident. There's going to be a proper investigation to find out exactly what happened. And then he sent one of his advisors to meet the family to assure them that there will be a proper investigation. But now look at this. Immediately after this news comes out that this girl has died, and of course the twist was, is given by these Persian language broadcasts from London and from other places that are financed by the Americans, the British government, and the Saudis. They started clamoring that this girl has been killed by quote-unquote morality police in Iran, and these people are killing, you know, innocent people, etc. And all of a sudden, these people come out in the streets. These are agent provocateurs. They are on the payroll of the United States. In fact, one of the leaders of that movement is a woman who is in the United States, an employee of the U.S. government, and in the last 5 or 6 years, she has received something like $800,000 from the United States. This is all reported in you know, media outlets. Of course, ones that are a little fair in their coverage rather than the mainstream media that keep on clamoring for the rights of the Iranian people. Of course, the Iranian people's rights must be respected. But look at the other side, that, you know, immediately after this, these people that came out protesting against the killing of this young girl, they went on a rampage. They attacked not only police stations, they attacked hospitals, they attacked mosques, they set ambulances on fire, they set buses on fire, they set banks on fire.
And they used guns.
Exactly.
Guns were,
and
people were shot.
They actually even attacked policemen doing their job. One policeman was, these people grabbed him and they slit his throat in the streets. They slaughtered him in the streets. And I don't think you are going to read about this in the Toronto Star or Globe and Mail or hear about it on the CBC. These are the kinds of things that these vandals were doing, and they were, of course, receiving encouragement from these Western governments. But at the same time, millions of people came out in different cities in Iran in support of the government. Millions, absolutely millions. Like, you know, you read the reports and see the coverage and the masses. It was not just in Tehran, repeatedly, not just, you know, one day, but on several days. Also in other cities in Iran, They say these people who are supporting the government, they said that we simply do not support this these crimes that these people are committing. And these are just a few hundred people, not tens of thousands of people. It is a complete lie that they put forward that, you know, all the people of Iran have come out, they are fed up with the government, etc. No, the people are, of course, in Iran facing difficulties, but that is because of these illegal sanctions that the United States government has imposed on Iran, mm-hmm. which has caused a lot of suffering to the Iranian people. Now, if the Americans and the Western regimes are so concerned about the well-being of the Iranian people, then they would lift the sanctions, because exactly. these sanctions have killed thousands of innocent people because they can't get medication from outside.
Yeah, I find it infuriating that they use terms like, oh, the people are angry at the economic collapse. And you say, well, yeah, but you're trying to engineer one. So, in other words, you're trying to provoke a situation. Incidentally, as far as I know, the economy actually has been fairly stabilized and is operating more successfully than it had been. But the effort to use economic means to crush Iran is since 1979.
Yes, exactly. And this obviously... you know, the economic managers in Iran and the government, they have done exceptionally well under the circumstances, but still there is a lot of economic sabotage, and it has created problems for the people because prices have gone up of essential commodities, although the government cushions the people by providing to the lower strata of society certain subsidies. So what they do is they allocate funds to the people that are earning below a certain threshold. So they provide them funds and tell them that, you know, here is additional money. You go and buy whatever you need. In the past, what the government was doing was that they would subsidize the prices of various items. Mm-hmm. But that was... you know, the rich and the poor both benefited from that. So the government was basically losing money because there are people that are really well off and they don't need any subsidies. So the government decided to give the people below a certain threshold income subsidies, direct money into their hands to tell them, now you can go and buy whatever you need. Mm-hmm. So that has cushioned the people at the lower end of the scale. But still, there are difficulties. There are economic problems in Iran. But as you said, Iran has managed quite successfully. But still, there are challenges and difficulties. And regrettably, these Western regimes are exploiting that.
Yes,
imagine, you know, Biden, in his United Nations speech, he says, we are with the people of Iran. We support their rights. Imagine if, let's say, Putin had come to the UN General Assembly and he had said that, we support the people of the United States. We support these, you know, QAnon people against this
brutal
regime. Well,
or all the riots that the United States has, or France.
Yeah.
France had sustained demonstration, not just one weekend, but weekend after weekend, and nobody here said a word.
Exactly.
Of support for them, and they were being shot by the French police, et cetera.
Yeah.
We're speaking to Zafar Bengash, Crescent International. And Zafar, you notice how studiously they avoid sort of obvious things. When there's an election, and there are regular elections of leaders and whatnot in Iran, the Western media gets all excited about particular candidates because they want them to win. But then when the elections are all over, they call everybody a dictator, a theocrat.
Exactly.
For certain people. They say, if he gets in, it's going to be good. And sometimes they even get what they want in a sense that they say, so-and-so is a middle of the road. He's a reformer. But the moment he doesn't do what they like, they say, he's just a theocrat, you know.
Exactly. Or they say that, he has no powers. He can't do anything, et cetera, et cetera.
They say, why did you want him so much? I have to ask you some factual, just to I was listening to CBC, and they covered some of the first demonstrations, particularly here in Canada. And I was very struck. They first of all, they say, here's a demonstration, and everybody's in favor of bringing down, this time it's different. They're going to bring down the government. And then they interviewed the son of the Shah. And I said, why would you talk about to the son of the Shah, and you're claiming you care about the people of Iran?
Exactly. You see, the thing is that they don't seem to be able to find any other candidate that they can point to who is going to.
They're now claiming it was freedom under the Shah.
Exactly.
I see the Toronto Star writes about it. They don't even question. Young people here or somebody they found in a park said, oh, we used to be free. Are you kidding? And I want to get to facts. I mean, I saw a tweet from an Islamic, a woman in the Islamic Republic, and she had made a little list. And she said, the number of women members of parliament under the Shah, there were 22. In the Islamic Republic, there are 120.
Yes.
And under the question of, and this is really big, because they talk, I was reading the man Menon in the Star, and he says, oh, all the women of Iran are supposed to stay in the kitchen. Well, how could that be the policy if they have the female university students in the Shah's time represented 6% of the student population? Under the Islamic Republic, 60%.
Exactly.
And women authors under the Shah, 50. Islamic Revolution, 8,000 plus.
Yes.
Women's sports coaches, Shah's time, 9. Islamic Revolution, 35,000. Now, I would love it if somebody wants to argue, but I mean, it seems to me the pattern is rather clear of broad involvement of women in the Islamic Republic in every field of life.
Exactly. You see, those are the kinds of facts that are not mentioned in the Western media because that goes against their agenda. If they were to report that there are women in every field of activity in the Islamic Republic of Iran, whether it's the education, medical field, industries, there are many women engineers in the Islamic Republic. You go to the offices, and women are not just secretaries in offices. They are actually holding managerial positions. There are women that are heading companies in the Islamic Republic of Iran. But you're not going to read about that or hear about that in any of the Western
media.
But,
you know, if they would just set that frame, they would be able to rebut the exaggerations by saying that can't actually compute. It doesn't, you know, if we were to say that.
That's correct, yes.
I mean, the guy Menon, and the culture guy in the Star, he said, they have to be at home and have it's kind of like the old Hitler formula. They had to be home having children and being in the kitchen.
Yes.
But, I mean, this is just a fact. My understanding is that it's particularly in the sciences where women have a higher percentage than males in the university.
Yes, yes.
The sciences.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, I have been to the Islamic Republic of Iran a few times. And I've got friends at the university who are professors who used to be students here in the early to late 80s. They are now professors there, and they've occasionally invited me to speak to their university students who are either doing their master's or PhDs, whatever. And as you mentioned, the women are in preponderance in the classrooms, and they are very informed, very well informed. They can articulate their position very clearly, very forcefully. And it was really, I have to say, it was a real pleasure and a treat to be discussing these issues with those students, particularly women students, because they were so well informed. They knew exactly what was going on in the world. They knew exactly what was going on in their own country and the surrounding countries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just look at the situation of the surrounding countries or countries that surround Iran. Look at the Arab countries around Iran, whether it's Saudi Arabia or United Arab Emirates or any of these other so-called mm-hmm. you know, sheikhdoms, etc. Women's education is very low. The Saudis have just come out of that primitive notion that women cannot drive cars, and now women are allowed to drive cars. But again, they are not permitted to demand basic rights. They end up in prison. In fact, it is so ironic that many of the women that were prior to 2018, when they were allowed to drive, many of the women that were calling for being allowed to drive cars were imprisoned, and they still remain in prison, although the Saudi regime has removed restrictions on women driving cars. So you see the irony of the situation that, you know, the United States says, well, Saudi Arabia is an ally, and it has been an ally for a long time, et cetera, et cetera. They don't see the contradictions of their own policies. And it is these kinds of contradictions that drive people mad in that part of the world, that they see the hypocrisy of U.S. policies and Western policies in general. They're all clamoring to rehabilitate the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, although the CIA itself said that he was intimately involved in the murder of that journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was not only murdered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, but then his body was dismembered and believed to be dissolved in acid so that there would be no trace left of him because his body has not been found. Mm-hmm. And the people that did carried out this gruesome act were actually recorded by the Turkish intelligence agency. And these people then, and these were all people that were basically advisors to the Saudi Crown Prince. And the CIA also said that Mohammed bin Salman was the one who gave the order to have Jamal Khashoggi murdered in this brutal manner.
Yes.
And yet, you know, it is business as usual in Saudi Arabia. Yeah. There are visits, there are, you know, agreements, etc. There is no question when they refer to the Saudi regime, they don't call it a regime, they call it a government.
Yes.
But when they refer to Iran, they call it the regime.
Yes. No, it's just a plain double standard, which, and I don't, by the way, I mean, they can get away with that in this, our media here, but around the world, it is clear. I mean, people can see it, which is why the votes in, when it comes to the United Nations, votes don't go the way the Americans would like them to go. And when they call themselves the world, everybody laughs because they only mean the Five Eyes group.
Yes. And of course, the other, as you mentioned, the UN, in the UN, the General Assembly has 193 members. That means that the General Assembly basically represents the voice of the global community. The Security Council has 15 members, of which five are permanent members. So basically, these five permanent members decide what is to be implemented and what is to be rejected. Now, the General Assembly's opinions are dismissed, whereas the resolutions that are passed through the approval of these five veto-wielding members are then imposed. So you see the basic injustice that exists even at that level. And the United Nations, of course, is a body that has to address or has to follow the instructions that these five permanent members, and even out of those five permanent members, actually three of them, which is the United States, Britain, and France, which are allies, are the ones that essentially dictate policy. And Russia and China only intervene if their interests are directly threatened or if their certain resolutions are being pushed through which will be detrimental to them, so then they use their veto power. Otherwise, they just go along with it. But basically, there are three countries, the U.S., Britain, and France, that dictate to the rest of the world, and they call this the will of the international community.
Yeah, it's this recent speech by Putin, everybody's talking about it, but what the one item in it that certainly will be listened to sympathetically by the developing world is that the policies of London and Washington are, frankly, neocolonial. They don't brook opposition. They don't talk to people as equals. Here's what it'll be. They give you the contract, you sign it, or they will take care of you.
Exactly. And
look what's happening, Burkina Faso, and places like this.
And if we can bring it back to the situation in Pakistan, that's exactly what happened over there, because Imran Khan was not going along with what the Americans were saying. So a low official of the State Department, his name is Donald Liu, who was sort of, the third-ranking officer in the State Department, he called the Pakistani ambassador, and he told him that unless you get rid of Imran Khan, there is going to be trouble for Pakistan. Can you imagine? This is a lowly official in the U.S. State Department, and of course the Pakistani ambassador duly communicated this information to the foreign ministry in Pakistan. And the day after Donald Liu made that threat, a no-confidence motion was presented against Imran Khan in the Pakistani parliament, of course, at the behest of the Pakistani military. So you can see that, as you said, the Americans and the British just don't brook any opposition. You have to do what they demand, otherwise they will get rid of that government.
Well, and by the way, we spoke to you some time back about this, and there is Imran Khan was not cooperating with the U.S., and of course he's beginning to say things in public that they hate to hear, and apparently the Pakistani population liked to hear. But with the change, there's issues. I noticed that someone from the Islamic Republic commented that on these recent demonstrations they had infiltration from two places, Kurdish district, which I want to ask you about that, but it seems to be a Kurdish aspect to this, these demonstrations and the young woman, but also they said in a border area with Pakistan they'd had problems with infiltration.
Yes.
And
now
that sounds like the old CIA business.
Yes. The Kurdish factor comes in because this girl that died was of Kurdish origin, although she was visiting relatives in Tehran. So, and there are, of course, the Islamic Republic has said that the Kurdish groups based in northern Iraq were also involved. They have actually captured weapons from them that they were smuggling into the Islamic Republic, as well as explosives. And they have arrested a number of people of those groups in Iran. With respect to this infiltration from the Pakistani side, this took place in the area, the border area of Balochistan. Now, Pakistan and Iran have this common border, the province of Balochistan. There are Balochis on both sides of the border, in Pakistan as well as in Iran. And since that border is very long, it's very rugged, it's very rough, it's not possible to monitor it completely. And so infiltration is quite easy to occur. And that is the area that is used by the CIA, by the Zionists, by the British. They're all involved over there, including Indian intelligence agency. They're all operating in the Pakistani side of Balochistan, and they quite easily infiltrate their saboteurs into the Islamic Republic of Iran to carry out these attacks. And of course, in a place called Zahedan, which is in the Irani side of Balochistan, it's a border town, there were some bomb explosions in which 20 people were killed. Four of them were policemen and 16 civilians. And these are the kinds of activities that are carried out against innocent people in the Islamic Republic of Iran by these saboteurs that are aided, abetted, and financed by foreign intelligence agencies.
Mm-hmm. This is Zafar Bengash, Crescent International. Zafar, also, and we spoke of this previous, and I really do think it should be followed closely, Afghanistan, the U.S.-backed government collapsed and ran, and the Americans ran, in order to leave chaos, is my opinion, so that they would those who drove them out would have to, instead of having a negotiated exit, it became a, you know, run for your lives kind of story. The U.S. has maintained they've frozen the assets of Afghanistan, will not return them to Afghanistan, which of course causes economic hardship. And now we're seeing also, again, bombs at mosques, attacks on particular ethnic groups. And it reminds me, we just like going back to where we started.
Yes. You see, as you mentioned, the Americans have frozen about $9.5 billion of Afghanistan's assets that are held in the United States. Now, the Americans are saying that we are not going to give this money to the Taliban. But this money does not belong to the Taliban. The Taliban have never claimed it. What they have said is that this money belongs to the Afghan people. And so the United States government should return this money immediately. And the American demand is that, well, we don't like certain people that are in charge of the Afghan Central Bank.
Yes.
So you remove them, and only then we are going to consider whether we are going to give you this money or not.
This is a thief talking to you. The thief is telling you what he's going to do with your money.
Exactly.
If you go to work for the thief.
Yeah, there is, of course, there was a recent new development, and that is that a couple of months ago, Biden had announced that he was going to use some of that money, about $3.5 billion of that money, for the families of the victims of 9/11. And the families of the victims of 9/11 were so appalled by this that they wrote an open letter to Biden. And they said, we don't want this money. You must return it to the people of Afghanistan. You are starving them, because the United Nations has said that
these are the families of the victims.
Exactly, that 90% of the population of Afghanistan is food deficient and threatened by famine. The situation in Afghanistan is so bad that families are forced to sell their children so that they wouldn't have to look after them and they would get some money to be able to survive. Mm-hmm. This is the situation in Afghanistan today. It does not have to be. It is deliberately being created by the United States in order to engineer the collapse of the current rulers of Afghanistan. But the recent development that I wanted to mention was that on September 19th, Biden's regime announced that they were transferring this $3.5 billion to Switzerland, where a special account is going to be set up, and funds from this account would go to finance various projects in Afghanistan, but not to be controlled by the Taliban. Now, the Taliban, again, have demanded that this money should be released, no condition should be put, but they are willing to go along with it because their condition is such that they cannot possibly do without some external help. There is another development which I think needs to be mentioned, and that is that there was an American contractor. When I say contractor, basically a person who was employed by Blackwater Mercenaries. His name is Mark Frerich. Now, they said that he was a civil engineer working in various projects in Kabul for the last 10 years, and he was also a U.S. Navy veteran. So that would give us an indication of where he came from.
Yes.
And in January of 2020, the Taliban kidnapped him. And they kidnapped him because the Americans were holding a Taliban supporter. His name is Bashir Nurzai. Although he's not an official member of the Taliban, but he was a successful businessman in Afghanistan, and he was very close to the Taliban founder, Mullah Omar, and he had, of course, provided a lot of financial support to the Taliban. So this fellow, Bashir Nurzai, was lured into a trap to go to the United States back in 2005. His American lawyer has said that the American government gave him assurances that if he came to the U.S. and he testified, there was a drug case underway, and this guy, Nourzai, was accused of being a drug warlord, smuggling drugs to the United States worth $50 million. But he was given assurances through his lawyer that he would not be put in prison. If he testifies and provides information, then he would be let go. He came to the U.S. under this assurance, and the Americans grabbed him and put him on trial and sentenced him to 25 years in prison. So it was as a consequence of that that the Taliban basically kidnapped this American contractor in Kabul in January of 2020, and the Taliban demanded that either the Americans release Bashir Nourzai because he has been tricked into going to the U.S., or we are not going to release this man, who's basically working for Blackwater, and so we are going to keep him under our, you know, control.
Mm-hmm.
And this finally was agreed upon again on September 19th. Bashir Nourzai was flown to Kabul, and Mark Frerich was handed over to the Americans in Kabul, not to the Americans, but to the United Nations, and then from there he was flown, and he is now free in the United States. So it seems to me that there are some behind-the-scenes negotiations are taking place, and the Taliban said that we are quite willing to talk to the Americans because we are anxious to get our money back so that we can put our country back on its feet.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously the Americans have a different agenda. They don't want Afghanistan to become stabilized. And at the same time, of course, the Americans, unfortunately, are backing these ISIS terrorists that even Hamid Karzai had said back in, you know, in an interview with CBS News in October of 2018 that Americans themselves are bringing ISIS from Syria. They are flowing them from Syria and Iraq into Afghanistan, and they want to create trouble for the Afghan people. And as you mentioned, last Friday there was a bomb explosion at an examination center in which these Hazara girls were taking exams. Now, just look at the irony. On the one hand, the Taliban are accused of not providing education to girls. But where they do provide education to girls, and these girls were taking, there were hundreds of those girls in that school taking exams, and they sent these terrorists over there to have a, you know, blow up a bomb over there. 40 of these women students were killed, and something like 160 or 170 of them were injured. But regrettably, there was very little concern expressed for these Afghan girls that were actually taking exams. They were studying, they were students, but that doesn't get any sort of mention, because then it would go against the narrative that is being peddled here that Taliban are against girls' education and they don't want to allow them to, you know, progress in society.
Yeah, they establish a narrative, and they, like good editors, they throw away the parts that don't match what they want to tell. Well, we've been speaking to Zafar Benti. It's been very edifying. Zafar, we're going to have to follow this closely. I guess maybe I should ask you. There was a demonstration in Richmond Hill.
Yes.
And Poiliev, was the speaker. The only prominent Canadian speaker was Mr. Poiliev.
Yes. Well, he's obviously.
And the star seemed a little confused because they're
a
Liberal Party.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
Unfortunately, he is very, you know, right-wing and hardcore sort of, you know.
Yeah, he wants to up the ante. He wants to ban, what is it, the Revolutionary Guard? He wants to declare Iran a terrorist country, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, can you imagine that this kind of sort of, you know,
that's
outrageous?
That's,
and he also
that's how
has
to solve
said
a problem.
That he is going to move
yes.
the Canadian embassy to Jerusalem. So you can imagine, see that, you know, where he's getting his instructions from. And Richmond Hill, of course, as you said, Richmond Hill is a liberal constituency. All the MPs in Richmond Hill and that region are all liberals. And Richmond Hill also has a very large Iranian community. But what is important to understand is that These are people that are against the Islamic Republic of Iran. They were basically Shah's supporters. Back in 2014, when the Shah's son was visiting Toronto, there was actually a big event held for him in Richmond Hill. So basically, you can see exactly the kind of thinking that these Iranians have. If you drive along Yonge Street from perhaps Elgin Mills down to about Finch, or up to even up to all the way to Shepherd Avenue, you will see Iranian stores all around, all along that stretch of road. And of course, as I mentioned, these are people that have that fled Iran, that are against the Islamic Republic of Iran. They are either pro Shah, or they are those other people, Mujahideen-e-Khalq, which is a terrorist outfit which the Americans and the British use, and American officials appear on their platforms regularly to try to destabilize the government in Iran.
Yeah, we're seeing evidence of destabilized Canada. There's something a little odd. As you said, that's a Liberal Party territory. And they apparently went to some pains to make sure he got to be up front, and no liberal of any note was seen on the platform. So it's very edifying. We're learning about Canada. This is how we find out about Canada.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Zafar Benghash, thank you very, very much. We really appreciate it. Look
it's
forward to talking
pleasure.
To you again.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Right. Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM.